This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Amazon, which, as you know, as we've been reporting, shocking Wall Street, projecting the slowest holiday growth quarter in the company's history. We've seen the stock plunge big time last night and the trade carrying over into the regular day today. Amazon's market value set to fall below $1 trillion after its disappointing earnings report. So let's get to it with our own Matt Day.
Matt Day is technology reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us via Zoom from Seattle. Matt, you've had close to 24 hours to dig into this, to report on this. The slowest ever growth for the company's holiday quarter. I mean, that's the part that really sticks out to me. What is it? Is this more of an Amazon story? Or is it more of an economy story?
I think it's both. Amazon's been trying to rein in costs all year. The last report showed they didn't really do that. And I think B of A analysts this morning, I think it was, who sounded the alarm and said, listen, if Amazon is projecting this week a holiday quarter and it could grow as low as 2%, then we might already be in a recession. That on its own is an indication that, you know, it's not just an Amazon story, but something's going wrong in the wider economy.
Having said that, what are, though, the Amazon-specific issues? Because there are some, right?
Oh, there are, yeah. When the pandemic hit and everybody, you know, went home and started shopping online for everything by choice or by need. Amazon started spending huge on new warehouses. You know, they were still building new data centers for their cloud computing business. And that worked out for, you know, call it 18 months. Late last year, when demand started to dry up, they realized they had way too much space, way too many people. And so they've been in cost cutting mode basically all year long. We've seen recently that spread to their corporate ranks as well. They're starting to wind down, you know, some of their marginal products, stuff that they didn't think was going to make it big. They've shut down their telehealth service. So they're still, you know, investing for the long term, as Amazon likes to remind folks. But they definitely overbuilt based on what they saw in 2020 and 2021.
What about that profit engine known as Amazon Web Services, AWS? What did we learn about the company in terms of how cloud growth is doing, especially in the context of what Microsoft reported earlier this week?
Yes, Microsoft gave a warning and Amazon gave maybe an even bigger one. 27% growth is great for a business that prints money, but it is the lowest ever since Amazon began breaking out AWS back in 2014. And one worrying thing for analysts on the call yesterday, now Amazon CFO said that some customers were asking for help cutting their bills and some pretty dour chatter about what businesses were doing with cloud spending. We didn't hear much of that at all during the pandemic. Cloud spending held up really well. So this suggests that this is something new for AWS.
Wait, am I crazy in thinking that we could be talking about Microsoft right now? Didn't Microsoft essentially say the exact same thing?
Yep, exactly right. And that's enough to compound the worry about a business that, you know, people have been saying is going to grow forever and throwing out a bunch of ludicrous figures on exactly how profitable it's going to be for Microsoft and Amazon. Amazon said they started seeing a lot of softness in their enterprise customers in the second half of third quarter, and then it's continued this quarter.
You know, it's interesting, too, and I know you wrote and reported earlier that, you know, we did see actually shares of Amazon and the market cap go below $1 trillion. Amazon shares, they're trading definitely off their worst levels of the session. In fact, it's just the biggest drop since May of 2022, so it's not like we haven't seen it in years, if you will. So how do you, I don't know, how do we spin this forward, Matt? How do we need to be thinking about this? Because I got to say, I keep saying to Tim all week, you know, my world is I'm ordering on Amazon, I'm watching Amazon Prime, I use lots of Apple products and I Google everything. So like that's my world. So these three companies, you know, and Amazon in particular, so entrenched in our worlds, or many of our worlds.
Yeah, long term, Amazon's probably going to be fine. They're not going to go out of business. You know, some analysts this morning are, you know, trying to calm that 25% drop we saw after hours last night. You've seen it; it bounced this morning, as you said.
Yeah.
Their advertising business is still growing. They're probably still going to take share there because they are just so close to people's wallets, right? You know, Google and Facebook have an idea what you buy. Amazon knows exactly what you buy, so their ad business is still a bright spot for them. Cloud growth, even if it's only 27%, that's still a very lucrative business that's got a long way to go. The long-term outlook is okay for them as long as they can get their costs under control.
Where are analysts most bullish when it comes to what Amazon can do? Is it that ad business? Because, I don't know, I mean, do Apple's IDFA changes affect that? It doesn't seem like it's a similar type of ad business because people, you know, are going there searching for what to buy and then they buy the product that they search for.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely a different story than kind of the gut punch to Facebook that change was. Yeah, ads is definitely a spot people are real optimistic about. Cloud is too. I mean, you've seen Amazon trade much more like a tech stock than a retail stock in the last, really, since they reported AWS results for the first time in 2015. So cloud's another obvious area where people are really upbeat. And I think in the long term, people still think that, you know, their retail business can show profits more than they have historically, right?
Matt.
Once they get... Right.
Matt, is there at some point we look at these companies that, you know, I mean, Amazon for a long time, right, we were just waiting for it to turn a profit and there was a lot of investing and finally it did. But at some point, what we consider maybe growth companies, all of a sudden they still grow, but they just don't grow at the dramatic rates. They become these behemoths, you know, in their industry and moving the needle gets harder and harder. Is that fair to say or maybe not?
I think it's definitely something worth watching for Amazon now. Like, have we hit peak Amazon? Was kind of the crazy growth we saw during the pandemic enough to call it and say, listen, this might be a different company now. One of the signs of that yesterday, analysts were asking on the conference call after earnings when Amazon might stop investing in new data centers. That is a crazy bit of caution and a suggestion that they should slow down growth on, you know, it's thought to be a potentially $1 trillion market opportunity, right?
Yeah.
So definitely some caution out there.
Right, a rethink. And I think about what Mike McKee talked about, like, was it some distribution facilities? It was in the latest growth data that you're not seeing as much of it happening. So you do wonder about this, right?
Yeah.
The retrenchment. Hey, Matt Day, thank you so much. Matt is technology reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us via Zoom from Seattle.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic. On Bloomberg Radio.
For just the second time ever, an entire issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine is dedicated to a single topic from a single writer. You might recall Paul Ford's What is Code? That was the first. Well, this time around, it is Bloomberg Opinion's Matt Levine giving us 40,000 words on digital assets, a primer on the innovation that could forever change the way we transact and how we view the world of finance. It is called The Crypto Story, Your Guide to What It Does, What It Means, and Why It Still Matters. Matt, as you know, covers finance. He was an editor of Dealbreaker, an investment banker at Goldman Sachs, an M&A lawyer at Wachtell Lipton, a clerk for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He joins us via Zoom from New York City, and he joins us along with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, Joel Weber. He is in our Interactive Broker studio. Joel, we want to get to Matt, but tell us a little bit about how this all came to be.
So earlier in the year, over the summer, we started watching crypto winter unfold. And we started to have several conversations that led to a big conversation where it was like, hey, what are all the various things we want to try and put in motion sooner rather than later? And out of that little huddle on the afternoon of June 17th, in the middle of that meeting, actually, the number one thing that everybody wanted was, how do we get Matt Levine to write something about crypto? And so I wrote in the middle of that meeting this note, hey there, to Matt. Hey there, any chance you'd like to write like 20,000 words for us sometime this summer? I could go approximately 18,000 words shorter or longer as you prefer. And built into that was this insurance policy that maybe if I couldn't get 20 or 40 or 60, like maybe I could get 2,000. And it took him about a week to reply. And in typical Matt fashion, he said, I have not replied to this. Sorry, because there is some chance. Like, it feels like a bad idea, but I kind of want to. What were you thinking? So that flirting led to where we are now. We have this amazing issue, which is totally just a testament to Matt. And he and I were talking earlier this week. We all adore right. Matt. We love his newsletter. We love money stuff. His Elon coverage has been sensational. And, you know, had any of this madness with Elon transpired any sooner, I don't think Matt would have actually done this. So thank you for, not having that chaos. But Matt, what was the thing when we started flirting, what was the thing that you felt was the spark that made you want to do this?
The thing that I really wanted to do is that, you know, crypto feels like a big enough subject that it could support an entire magazine issue, but it's also like a small enough subject that it feels like one person could almost get their mind around all of it and then like type sequentially an explanation of all of it. So you can sort of start from the first principles, and there's like a real obvious starting point where the Satoshi Nakamoto Bitcoin white paper is like, hey, I've got this idea for crypto. And then everything more or less comes out of that. So you can kind of start from the beginning and build from the basic concepts up to all of the complicated stuff that exists today. And that just seemed like a really fun challenge to try to cover everything. And of course, in the end, long though it is, it doesn't cover everything. But like, it felt like a good thing to try.
So the title, it started as me saying what is crypto, which, you know, was loosely inspired by the Paul Ford thing. That was the closest approximation that I could come up with. What was your title, Matt, and why?
I wouldn't say I had a title. I had a working title. There you go. Half-joking working title, which was, what was crypto? Because we were sort of joking about the fact that in some ways, you know, it feels a little silly to do this during crypto winter. Although actually, I think that ended up being helpful because you're not kind of covering the market moves of the moment, but you're kind of taking a step back and looking at the sort of broad sweep of crypto.
What's kind of cool is, and I have to say, Matt, loved it. I've read it. I've had to reread things a couple of times because I feel like, though, for the first time, I understand so much of crypto, and I realize how many things I probably was either using terminology wrong and I just didn't have an understanding. So thank you for that. And I do think in terms of crypto, love it, hate it, you write, in the past 14 years, crypto has built a whole financial system from scratch. Whether it works or not, that's kind of cool, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, as I say in the piece, I come to this from finance, and my interest is not so much in like, ooh, we're re-engineering the internet and society. My interest is like, they do cool financial stuff. And I think that for me, watching crypto has been fascinating because it's a mix of like very clever, essentially financial engineers and like engineers who are looking at the problems of existing finance and saying, we have a better idea. But also watching people who sort of like are 23 and like know how to program a computer and like have never heard of the 2008 financial crisis and are like just doing it all over again and making the same mistakes in kind of hilarious fashion. So you get both, right? You get like real, like clever financial innovations and also like disasters you can see coming a mile away.
So let's talk about some of the financial innovations before we talk about some of the disasters. To what extent have you seen the financial innovations actually make their way into the traditional finance system, if at all?
Not too much. You know, you see banks announcing we're going to do a blockchain project, right? And like every time I make fun of that, I get an email from someone at a bank being like, well, we actually deployed a test example of our blockchain product. But in general, like, I don't think that, you know, the innovations of decentralized finance have come to a stock exchange near you. But what you have seen is people from traditional finance leaving to go to crypto. Now, that was largely a feature of the crypto bull market, and some of them are kind of creeping back to traditional finance now. But I do think it was also a testament to like the interestingness of that, where like if you felt like you were you wanted to build stuff in finance, or you wanted to like kind of, you know, you saw a problem in the existing infrastructure and you wanted to make something different, the place where that was easiest to do, where you had the blankest canvas, was in crypto. And so a lot of smart people did leave their, you know, hedge fund or high frequency trading jobs to trade crypto instead. So it's not so much that crypto took over traditional finance, but that, you know, it kind of hired away from it.
Okay, so the first time I got to read the draft was in early August, and Pat Rignier, who's the story editor, actually cracked it before I could get to it, but he immediately flagged what was the first line, and I think it has not changed since you filed it. And the first line is, modern life consists in large part of entries in databases. And what was magical to me about that was that we're gonna end up with a story, 40,000 words about crypto, and you don't start there. You start somewhere else. And can you share how that line came to you and why you thought that was the perfect place to begin?
Well, I think that if you're going to take crypto seriously, you have to sort of start with like, what problem is it meant to solve? Like what, in some ways, you know, I say I want to start at the beginning and go to the end, but you have to start before the beginning, right? You have to start with like, what is Satoshi Nakamoto sitting around thinking about in 2007 that inspires him to write the Bitcoin white paper, right? Like why have crypto? And I think that the answer has to do with like, one, the sort of computerization of the world, where it's like easier and easier to kind of see that so much of life consists of like data structures. And then also with this like breakdown in trust, where, you know, as I say, like the world consists of a lot of entries in databases, and you have like real pressure on trusting the keepers of the databases, right? You have real worries about, you know, in 2008, you had real worries about banks. And that's like the sort of like immediate impetus for Bitcoin, right? You don't trust the bank to keep a record of your money, not so much because they're not trustworthy at doing that, but because you sort of don't trust them generally, or you don't trust the system, you know, you don't trust regulation. And that kind of ramifies into a lot of other places where you don't want to rely on some single party. You don't want to rely on Facebook to kind of keep track of the social graph. And so that I think is like kind of the spark for crypto in many ways is saying like, you know, if we come up with a better way to keep a database that doesn't rely on trusting centralized parties, then that's good. And that's kind of, you know, I wanted to start with like what motivates this rather than like, you know, blockchain.
Well, I have to say, like, this whole idea of trust, I love how you kind of wove it through everything, right? Like, I throw money in a bank, I expect it to be there. I invest money in my 401k, I expect it to be there.
Well, but not the 401k thing isn't really working this year.
It's not.
Sorry.
But I mean, it's like digital, right? Like, I have no interaction with the people who are really, you know, covering it for me. There's so much trust when it comes to crypto. I keep thinking about, like, who are these people? Why should we trust them ultimately? And I understand that if the system doesn't work, then nobody's going to be wanting to participate in it. But I feel like we still don't know these people, you know what I mean, that are behind it. How do you feel about it, having kind of broken it down?
Well, you don't know Jamie, maybe you do, but I don't know Jamie Dimon personally either. You know, like,
I just had lunch with him. No.
Right. Like another reason I wanted to start there is like to convey like just like the strangeness of trust in our everyday life. That is sort of like, you know, I wanted to defamiliarize that a little bit and be like, look, your whole life is databases and you trust the people who keep them. And like, you don't think about it, right? Because like, that's just true in the world. And like, you have to like think of the reasons why you trust the keepers of databases. And some large part of that is like there's this regulatory structure where like we sort of trust the government not to let people do crimes with our money, you know. And then other parts of it are like relying on market incentives where, like, you know, you can kind of like look at a company and be like, well, if this company was stealing people's money, it probably wouldn't be advertising on the subway because people would stop giving it their money. You know, you're sort of like relying on other people to kind of do the investigation for you. And in crypto, you know, like it's the same sort of basic set of things, but the mix is different, right? So in crypto, there's, you know, in round numbers, there's no government regulation, right? I mean, there's actually a lot. There's a lot of people doing a lot of things to regulate crypto. But like any given project that you look at in crypto, there's some chance that no regulator has thought about it, right? And they've certainly not like approved it. Certainly there's not legislation being like, here's the steps you need to take to become a stablecoin in the US, right? I mean, like there's prospective legislation, but there's not like a real kind of like working regulatory framework. And so, you know, in much of our lives, we trust, you know, people because there is a regulatory structure around them, and here there isn't, and that's weird. And in many cases makes things less trustworthy. And so we saw in the crypto meltdown, a lot of like customer facing brokerages, you know, kind of like lost their customers' money because they were sort of doing very levered trades without telling anyone about it. There's the market incentives thing, which in crypto is a big deal, right? Like mm-hmm. you sort of go around thinking, well, if this is a big crypto exchange, it's probably trustworthy because everyone else is trusting it, right? And that as a heuristic, that's not terrible, but it has, you know, in the past, the biggest Bitcoin exchange at the time has blown up. So it's not a perfect heuristic by any means, nor is it in traditional finance, right? Big banks have blown up. And then the third thing in crypto is like, there is this notion that like, not in all of crypto, but in lots of crypto and like in like the core of Bitcoin and in like decentralized finance, there is this notion that you can look at the code yourself, that everything is verifiable yourself. You can look at the code, see how it works. You can look at the ledger of transactions, the blockchain, and prove that every transaction is correct. And so you say you don't have to trust. You can verify everything without trusting it. In practice, you're not doing that because it would take forever, but you are, you're sort of trusting the fact that you could do that verification. So you have, you don't have to have as much trust in individuals, but that's not like the only thing in crypto. I mean, the crypto evangelists will talk about that being like the trustless nature of crypto, but obviously like day to day, a lot of stuff in crypto involves trusting, you know, companies and like individuals with your crypto. Mm-hmm. And often those people turn out not to be trustworthy.
Yeah. We could do an entire program on talking about, you know, the history of crypto and the grifters or alleged mm-hmm. grifters, I
colorful,
should say.
Colorful characters.
Exactly. Yeah. We're speaking with Matt Levine. He's a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. The story is his in a Bloomberg Business Week magazine this week. If you haven't read it yet, I think you're the only one. It is on the Bloomberg terminal.
Untrue.
It's a lot of words to get through. Yeah, 40,000.
Okay, if you haven't started reading it yet, you might be the only one. We also have Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Matt, I want to hear more about your perceptions and conceptions of crypto before going into this versus after doing the reporting and writing. Like, you must have gone in with some sort of notion, and I'm wondering what that was and if it changed by the end.
I wouldn't say it changed too dramatically. And part of, you know, I don't come to the story with an angle in the sense of like, I'm a crypto booster or I'm a, you know, crypto hater. And I kind of felt like that was the only way to do it, right? Like, I feel like I read a lot by crypto boosters that is very enthusiastic, but like very kind of in the weeds and jargony and like, you know, sort of assumes you're already a believer. And I read a lot of stuff by skeptics that is just angry. And I wanted to sort of find a middle ground. But like, I do come to it from the perspective of I am a financial writer and I'm most interested in the crypto financial system. Hmm. And so in writing this, I found myself often charmed by the crypto financial system and by like the cleverness of like what people were doing in decentralized finance and by the enthusiasm of people who work in crypto finance, not just about like making a lot of money, but about how someone said to me, things just work in crypto. Like you just like, if you want to like start trading stuff, you like plug into the exchange and you start trading the stuff. And in traditional finance, there's a lot more like process, right? There's a lot more like you like call a bank and they send you a contract so you can sign up an account. And then like, you know, you have to like call someone else to like hook up your data to the exchange. And it's just like a more manual, complicated, subjective you know, process where like insiders sort of get more access. And in crypto, everything is sort of straightforward and computerized. And that's like what people told me. Like, that's like, that was the thing they liked, that they could sort of start a product, start trading something, come up with an idea and implement it without like sort of getting anyone's permission. Obviously there's a flip side to that, which is that like you don't get the regulator's permission and sometimes the product is like, you know, theft. But that was a thing that like I was struck by people's enthusiasm for that, because I think that when I was, you know, when I've written my column about crypto, I've often thought of crypto as being, you know, people call the blockchain a slow database. And I think of it as being a sort of like a difficult to use system in some ways, because it is unintuitive to outsiders. But I think when the people who use it find it so much easier to use than traditional finance, because it is, you know, kind of like disintermediated and permissionless, and just like you can like read the documents and then go do the thing.
So Matt, haters are going to hate, and crypto haters will ask, sure, 40,000 words, what's crypto for still?
Yeah, look, ever? I mean, I share that skepticism, you know, like there are people tell stories about how crypto is changing or will change your day-to-day life, and I often find those stories not particularly compelling, right? There's a lot of like, you could own a share in the bands you like, and then if those bands become popular, you'll get rich. It's like, why? What? Like, how is that a thing? You can like own your data on like your social networks, and you can get paid to serve ads to you. Like, it's like these stories of sort of like micropayments and of like ownership, like sort of financializing everything that, you know, like I'm a finance guy. I like a certain amount of financialization, but I also like spent a long time reading about like, we're going to like sell equity in college students so that you can like bet on their futures. And like, you know, now I'm like, okay, yeah, people are going to keep writing that. It's never going to happen, right? Like there are some things that sort of resist financialization, and crypto is like, we're going to financialize everything at once. And that seems implausible to me. So in that sense, like I am like, I think there's, you know, potential like stories like that will come true, but I'm not super bullish on like, we're going to have a coin for everything that you do in your life.
Matt, let me just ask you, because, you know, we lost, what, $2 trillion in crypto wealth, right? That happened. Sure. And yet, as you point out in the magazine, you know, it's not like the rest of the financial markets or the economy came undone because of that. So what is the meaning of it? You know, what does that say about the future in terms of the value of crypto? And that, first of all, we're glad it didn't bring down the markets. But I mean, what does it say about its real value going forward? Or maybe it doesn't. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, first of all, we lost a lot more than $2 trillion of stock market wealth, you know, this year, like,
right.
Crypto, whatever else it is a very speculative asset class, right? Like people who invest in crypto for the most part are like, this is a fun gamble more than they are like, this is where I'm putting my life savings because it's like, and it promised me a steady 2% return. So the fact that it crashed, you know, people who were betting on it going up, it went down, but they could sort of afford to take that loss because it was essentially a speculative asset. So that's one reason that it didn't really like ramify to the rest of the economy. But the other reason is definitely that like, you're not, you know, financing your home or your, you know, your business by like going to the crypto lender. And so crypto is not super integrated into like the financing of real world activity. So it is, you know, when it crashes, it's not like the crypto bank shuts down and you can't get a mortgage for your house.
Right.
Like you can still go to the regular bank. So yeah, I mean, I think I've said that like to the, if the next crypto financial crisis, because there really was a crypto financial crisis this year with like failing, you know, lenders. If the next crypto financial crisis causes a slowdown in the real economy, then you'll be like, oh, crypto arrived. Like crypto is now like meaningfully integrated into everyone's lives, such that when it crashes, that affects the world. We're not quite there yet.
So Matt, you know, we do this every week. I'm wondering what's your next single topic issue takeover of the magazine, and what kind of deadline I can give you now that
you
we've done this once.
You taking your crypto and running?
Well, you know, I'm gonna do a retrospective on Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Oh,
all wow. right. I'll go grab
I'm
my
not
catcher.
Really. Not
catcher
really. Never gonna write about it again. Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna write about it again.
Why not, Joel? I mean, I guess the question is kind of where the story goes from here, Joel.
To me, that is the most interesting part about crypto, right? And I won't even pretend to know. And that wasn't really the goal of the project. Although I think Matt poses some really, and I don't want to give away the ending because it's a really majestic way that I think he wrestles with this question. And boy, I will just say, having been editor of Business Week for a while, worked at Bloomberg for 10 years, it's just like this story makes you just want to get a bowl of popcorn, read the issue to make sense of everything that we've all lived through, and also just keep eating that popcorn to see what happens. Like, I'm really deeply curious, and that was the curiosity that I think Matt infused into this story. And I mean, we're just honored to have published it.
Matt, you should know, and Joel, you should know that in the newsroom, people have been hunting down for the issue. We typically
I'll have
you know,
them. How much Bitcoin you've got to give me, but yeah.
But I'm just telling you, everybody wants the issue to read, and it's like we've been like, "Do you have the issue? Do you have the issue?" Matt, thank you so much. I really mean it. Like, I've learned so much, and I think everybody who reads it does. It is called "The Crypto Story: Your Guide to What It Does, What It Means, and Why It Still Matters," written by Bloomberg Opinion's Matt Levine. Check it out. As we said, it's the entire issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. And our thanks to Joel Weber, editor of the magazine, who
I guess you had something to do with it, Joel.
Small. Matt and Pat get the most props.
Well, Joel, thank you for joining us. Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so speaking of meta platforms, they talked an awful lot about the metaverse this week and continuing to spend money on it. And, you know, our next guest has some real smart thoughts about it when it comes to shopping in the metaverse.
We're pleased to have back with us Neha Singh, founder and CEO of Obsess. It's a shoppable virtual store platform, and it offers consumers a way that they can shop and experience their products online and in the metaverse. Neha, good to have you back with us. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me, Tim and Cal.
So when we think about established brands in the metaverse, should we think about this as a way to kind of like the way that companies started offering their products online, you know, instead of sending you catalogs 20 years ago, you could go to, you know, I don't know, name the company, Patagonia.com, and actually look at a jacket there. Is this is the same thing happening now in terms of the metaverse?
Yes, absolutely. So the way, like, you know, we define the metaverse is that it is the next generation of the internet. Like, if you think about their website started in the 90s, right? They were very plain. They had mostly text, and then we added images, and then we added videos. And now with the hardware capabilities that are there in the market, as well as our, you know, network speeds pushing into 5G and more, it's just possible to do much richer graphical interfaces online. And that's really what's leading to the metaverse, which is a 3D version of the internet. So what you're seeing brands do now is that they are starting to create these more 3D immersive experiences that are actually closer to the real world, right? Because the real world is 3D. It's all around us. We don't look at the real world in a database like we do most of online shopping today. So it's just that technology is now getting to the point that that's possible, and that this is all happening on mobile devices and on desktop computers. You don't require like VR headsets and, you know, to put goggles. It's all happening on the devices that you already have.
I try to think where this could go, Neha, and I think about, you know, could I essentially have a body scan of me so that there's an avatar that with my dimensions exactly, and I go to the metaverse and I go shopping at a mall, or I go shopping down, you know, a street in New York City, pop into shops, and I can actually try on clothes with the right digital dimensions, and I can really get a feel of how things fit. Like, is there something there that makes me want to do it? Because I got to tell you, I like living in the real life. So this idea of shopping, you know, I just can't get my head around it. So I'm trying to think, is there some super level that will get us there?
Yeah, so two parts to that. First of all, what you described with, you know, having kind of your avatar in the metaverse and having your exact dimensions and trying on clothes, that's absolutely sort of the holy grail of the future of fashion shopping. We are not there yet in terms of having the full technology to be, you know, able to have that body scan easily or try on clothes easily, because not all brands have 3D models of their products yet. But that is the direction that we are heading into. But the second part I would say is, like, think about the things that we are doing with brands in the metaverse today is not like you are going into some other world, and it's actually not that foreign. So it is really an improvement over today's online shopping interface, which is good for, you know, if you want, if you know exactly what you want to buy and you can search and filter and get to it, and it's very efficient, right? But when you go shopping in real life in stores, there's a lot of discovery, and you almost like it's an entertainment experience because you're getting that inspiration from the brand and you know their stories. So
it kind of reminds me of the way that we saw news transition from newspapers to online, and the way that some people still really like to hold on to a newspaper, you know, on a Sunday, because they might actually see or encounter an article that they wouldn't necessarily click on if it were presented to them on a web page, for example. So how do you replicate that in the metaverse, Neha?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's exactly what the brands that we are working with are doing, is that they are creating these virtual environments that, again, it's very easy for you to access. It's not like you are going into the metaverse and you don't have to become an avatar if you don't want to. It's really a different interface for exploring products in which you know, you can discover things that you weren't necessarily like looking for. And we actually see that from the data, is that customers are buying more in these environments because, similar to a retail store, you might just come across something that you weren't necessarily looking for. And it's ultimately a more intuitive shopping interface, because while most brands come to us to target a younger audience who's super used to gaming, right? And this interface is very similar to gaming,
right?
In terms of moving to a 3D environment. But then we also have customers that are high-end luxury brands, and their typical demographic is much older, and they're seeing great results because, well, ultimately it's very intuitive. It's like, you know, what you do in real life.
Neha, we got to run, but we'll check in with you real soon. Neha Singh, founder and CEO of Obsess, joining us via Zoom from New York City.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we are getting ready to wrap up the last full week of October trading, which is pretty remarkable. And look at the rally underway.
Wait, really? We are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. November starts next week. I mean, not on Monday, but right? 30 days has September.
Yeah, so
31st.
Yeah, it's last full week. Yeah, so we still got one more.
Yeah,
we got one more day of lunch at the office.
But look at the rally.
I'm thinking about.
We had it. No, it finished.
Today's the last day.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, we're kind of all over the place, but that's the kind of week it has been.
Sorry, that's just me.
But as Charlie mentioned, stocks holding on to their gains.
Let's get into it with Michael Sheldon, Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group, joining us once again on the phone from Westport, Connecticut. Michael, good to have you back with us. How you doing?
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
So are we out of the woods?
Well, this week has certainly been an impressive rally. I think you have to sort of step back a little bit. The markets bottomed around October 13th or so. So this is sort of the fourth multi-week rally that we've had in this bear market that started back in January. And when the markets hit their lows October 13th, I think sentiment was really pretty negative. And a couple other things have contributed recently. There's been a little bit of a pullback in the dollar, which has been super strong this year.
Mm-hmm.
And interest rates have started to pull back a little bit as well. So next week will be really interesting because the Fed meets November 1st and 2nd, and there's a lot of anticipation of what they will or won't say and whether they'll start to make their shift. But this has certainly been an impressive rally so far. One thing just to mention is that the Dow, interestingly, after today, is the first of the major indices to move back above their key 200-day moving averages. So that's something a lot of investors watch, separating a longer-term rally versus a short-term rally. None of the other major markets have done that, but that's certainly something to monitor going forward.
So, sorry, Carol.
No, you go.
So we could be out of the woods when it comes to the Dow because of that technical, but proceed with caution. I mean, what's the takeaway there?
Well, I think it's certainly an encouraging sign when the markets, when the different indices move above their 200-day moving average. Historically, at least, that helps separate a short-term move from a longer-term, more sustainable move. But I think in terms of whether we're out of the woods, I think it's a little, certainly in our opinion, a little bit too early to say that. If you look at some of the economic data, and I think it's really important to keep an eye on the consumer, for example, because that represents two-thirds of the economy. So on the positive side, looking at the consumer, you have the lowest unemployment since 1969, and you have wages growing at 5%, but that's being offset by higher inflation and rising rates, which are affecting the equity and housing market. So the consumer appears to be pretty resilient, and you know that sort of fits in with whether we're in a recession or going into a recession. And so I think there's still some uncertainty about that and what the Fed will be doing at their next meeting.
It's funny, too, that you mentioned the Dow. I mean, I feel like we live in a world where people kind of blow the Dow to the side and think about, okay, what's the S&P doing? What's the NASDAQ 100 doing? So how do you kind of factor in what's going on with the Dow above it, back above its technical move, you know, above its 200-day, Michael,
right,
versus what we're seeing on the S&P and the NASDAQ, which is much more representative of a broader part of the market?
Yeah, that's a great question. And if you're in the financial markets like we are every day, most individual investors follow the Dow. That's what gets all the headlines. You see them on the newspapers and on the news. But people who follow the markets on a regular basis really follow the S&P 500. And one of the things we're seeing, which is really interesting, is I think you're starting to see in the past couple of weeks a shift, unfortunately, out of technology, which has been the market leader for much of the past decade or so. And the shift is out of technology stocks. We already started to see some of the money-losing high-valuation stocks get hit starting in 2021. But the shift is, for example, if you look at the equal-weighted S&P 500 this week, that's up about 5.4%, while the S&P 500, which is market cap-weighted, is up just 3.9%. So not a big difference, and it's only this week. But I think that's an interesting trend that we'll have to watch heading into the end of this year and next year.
Can I just look, you know, it's funny. I was just kind of picking apart the market here as you're talking. Industrials are up almost 7% this week. Utilities are up almost 7%. Yeah, I mean, real estate, financials. I mean, most of the 10 of the 11 major industry groups in the S&P 500 are higher, but it's consumer staples, financials, real estate, utilities, industrials at the top. What does that tell you, Michael?
Well, I think it's sort of a mixed bag. Industrials have been improving recently. We've seen some better relative strength in some of those stocks. I think investors are still trying to figure out if we're going to be going into a recession or not. And if we are in a recession, is it going to be a mild recession, which to us seems like the most likely scenario, because you don't have the kind of major imbalances this time around that you did, for example, in the banks going into 2008. Consumers generally although the consumer, the household savings rate is down to, I think, about 3.4%. Households in general don't seem to be, household savings in general seem to be okay. Household balance sheets seem to be okay. The one thing that we're starting to watch is housing is starting to come down, and that's interest sensitive, so that makes sense. But in terms of the sectors, one of the other things to watch, for example, is small caps, which has done well, and that's sort of, small caps would do better if we're coming out of a recession and there's sort of more speculation and people are more optimistic. So I think it's too early to sound the all clear, and it'll be interesting especially to see what the Fed says next week and what the employment numbers come out as next week as well.
It's a loaded week next week.
Yeah. Do you expect the Fed to, I don't know, give us some sort of guidance that they're still looking at, that they're considering 75 basis points for December?
Well, I think it's, I think 75 basis points for November is pretty much baked in the cake. Mm-hmm. But I think for December, that's an interesting, that'll be a more interesting meeting. For this meeting, we don't have the inflation data in front of us. We had already the inflation data that came out today, for example.
Right.
The Fed's favorite core PCE index actually rose month over month to 5.1%, which is the highest level since, I think, back in March when it was 5.4%. But at the Fed meeting next week or in 2 weeks, I think the keys to watch will be, one, does the Fed say we're making progress on inflation, which would be a signal that they're starting to shift policy, or two, do they say that inflation remains higher than we'd like, which continues to be the party line in recent weeks, and will probably indicate a 75 basis point hike in December may be more likely.
All right, we're going to leave it on that. Hey, Michael, have a great weekend. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Michael Sheldon, Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group based in Westport, and that's where we find him on the phone on this Friday.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.